Hi, this is John Udell. Back in October, I gave a talk in Ann Arbor, Michigan, entitled Super Librarians and Super Patrons. It was inspired by the two gentlemen who joined me for today's podcast. The super librarian is John Bleiberg, who works at the Ann Arbor District Library and who reconfigured the catalog system used by that library so that patrons could make mashups of the services that it offers. The super patron is Ed Villametti, someone who has a long history with internet development and who's been doing all sorts of interesting things with the APIs that John Bleiberg has made available. Ann Arbor is lucky to have these two guys working both ends of the street. Together, they're a great example of how providers and users of technology can collaborate. We got everybody?
Yep.
I'm here.
I thought that it would be best to really focus on one particular thing here, and that would be the relationship between a super librarian and a super patron. You guys are the best example of, or really in a way the only example of that idea. What I'd like to hear from you guys is, first of all, John, I'd like to hear from you on some of the adaptations that you've made to the innovative system that your library runs, and what your intent was there, and how you came to be involved working with Ed as the lead user of the improvements that you were making. And then, likewise, Ed, fill us in from your perspective on how, on just how that came about.
Okay. Well, first of all, I think Ed sort of came to us more than anything else. He's been a really great help in trying to get the stuff moving and online. He's just always been a advocate for the library, so we're lucky to have him. In terms of what we're doing here and what we've done to our innovative system, we've really taken a two-prong approach. And on one hand, we have the modification of data distribution channels at the distribution layer, as well as modifying the existing system presentation-wise.
Which of those things qualifies as the API that you've built on top of it?
I would say that would be distribution.
Okay.
Certainly, because that then allows users to come, grab our data, and then present it in the way that they want to present it, not necessarily the way we have it
right.
Presented on our website.
From your perspective as a developer, someone who does that is a user, but from most people's perspective, a user is someone who comes to the web and looks up books in the off-the-shelf version of the interface. Someone who reaches past that surface to the custom API that you've built in order to do special things with it is a very special kind of user.
You're absolutely right, but I think that there are more quote-unquote users who take that next step, and sort of the line between developer and user is certainly becoming more blurred in a Web 2 world, because where does the idea of being a power user and a developer begin when you're really talking about providing a set of simple tools and a very simple API
mm-hmm.
to a group of people who are using tools that make development really easy. And so providing a simple and easy to understand API seems just a logical next step in providing users with that experience.
Okay. So tell us what it is that you've done, what you call the API that you've wrapped around your system, and a little bit about how that works for various levels of skilled use.
Okay. Well, the traditional API for libraries tends to be pretty technical. Oftentimes you need a pretty good understanding of MARC and XML and that sort of thing. So what I wanted to do is create something that was very patron-oriented, very user-oriented, and I called it PatRest, for patron rest. And
mm-hmm.
it's a REST-based implementation where users can just form basic URI structures to grab data out of the catalog, and then that XML schema is presented and formatted in a really easy and intuitive format that would make it easy to understand and parse and reuse.
And under the covers, your implementation is talking to a deeper API layer inside of Innovative, or it is talking to, it's basically screen scraping the web?
It does a little bit of both.
Okay.
Innovative comes with a couple API layers, one of which is called their XML server, and it's very rudimentary and allows you to just pull some basic bibliographical data out of their system and use it that way. But it's very difficult to parse through, and it's not something that I would really want to make available to the public because it's so difficult to parse through.
Okay.
And then coupled with that, we do have a middleware layer that goes to the innovative system and does a fair amount of screen scraping and then presents it back up to that distribution layer.
Okay, so sort of a multi-pronged approach. So Ed, from your perspective, tell us about some of the kinds of things that you've yourself been able to do using the system that John's produced, and then we can branch out and look at how that could be extended.
I asked the library if they were going to have an RSS feed and got the feedback back that they were doing a whole new system, and so
There's
a certain amount of interest and excitement coming from that. Initially, the RSS perspective was the easiest one that I figured was a way to get to things. I knew that that was going to be fairly easy to parse and pretty standard, and that I wouldn't have to invent a lot of complicated tools to parse it. Could use existing libraries and software and whatnot to manage that sort of interface.
Right.
So got involved as part of the technology advisory board for the library as they were doing the rollout of the new catalog, and then really started to innovate initially around the RSS output that the library had from things like search queries and patron holdings records, books that you were had currently checked out, other things like that.
Okay. Now, just to be clear, how much of this was native functionality and how much of it is stuff that John had to add?
My perception of it was that none of this was native in the innovative catalog. This was all
right.
A byproduct of using the Drupal system as the engine for display. Is that right, John?
Yeah, that's absolutely right.
Okay.
At the time, innovative didn't offer any of that sort of thing, so we built all that on top of it.
Okay. But now they do?
I should mention that, yeah, now they do have some products available that do some basic RSS feeds and some other socially based things. We didn't purchase that product. It's called Encore. But they've since done a few things.
Okay.
RSS-wise.
You're on the system where to provide all of these things to Ed, it's because you've provided them.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, and so the initial sort of burst of creativity, and I'll call it that because it wasn't really goal-directed, it was more exploratory, was doing things like creating a sidebar in my blog with the books that I currently had checked out in it, because there was a private feed that I could get access to that had a list of my current checkouts in it as RSS, so I was able to syndicate that in through RSS to JavaScript interface.
Mm-hmm.
I created an interface of just the covers of all of the new books that had been added to the library's collection in the last, so many days.
I remember that one, and that's actually an incredibly useful thing.
One of these days I'm going to reinvigorate that and make that live. I find myself really wanting that all the time.
Right. So let me just clarify what happened there, which is that you, Ed, a patron of the library, created a service which visualized the new books for potentially any library patron in that system.
And I was able to do that not because the library had explicitly designed anything, but because they had provided an interface that was standard enough that I could write code to it and reliable enough that I could count on it without having to do a lot of parsing or anything.
Right.
Just the fact that the library interface was simple and standardized made a huge amount of difference. And I'll contrast that with the two other things that it could be. It could be complicated and standardized, so it could be like a Z3950 interface to a catalog, in which case you're talking about enormous libraries to parse the data, and it's standard, but it's a standard that's not accessible by most people.
Yep.
Or you have the non-standard approach to things, which is essentially screen scraping for most library catalogs, of a certain vintage out there, where to build anything, you sort of have to reverse engineer how the page was laid out.
Yeah. So then I wanted to ask you, John, about this notion that in addition to having enabled somebody like Ed who can cut a little bit of code to do these things, you've also pointed out that by designing a very clean and rational system of URL patterns, you've in principle enabled anyone who can form URLs in a browser to do some interesting things.
I mean, I've always been sort of impressed with the idea of sort of developer networks behind organizations. And so by doing this, I wanted to create an easy way into the system to help facilitate that. So when looking at the RSS feeds, you're consuming a read-only resource. So I wanted to go beyond that and be able to provide a read-write interface and still have it be very easy to understand, very clean. And so by forming your URL or your URI in such a way that's predetermined, developers can go and either grab data out of the data of the system, whether it be bibliographical data or search data or even a user's current checkout. That's been made available. But in addition to that, users can also place holds, renew items, and do that sort of thing. So, and in the future, why not continue that vein and let people pay fines or tag records or submit reviews, you know, so that they can do that all from within the confines of whatever their application is that's consuming this resource.
Let's focus on the placing a book on hold scenario. My library doesn't currently allow me to do that through the web, so I have to kind of come in and fill out a piece of paper, and of course I rarely manage to do that. In this case, you could simply provide the feature through the web, which is what I would imagine most libraries that have the feature do. However, you've actually decoupled that so that you've got a separation between the implementation, putting a book on hold, and the invocation of that action, such that somebody else can come along and potentially in a very, very simple way invoke that action in a context different than the one that you've presented, let's say, on your library's website. Now, why might that matter?
Say you're a sort of a hardcore Mac user, for instance, and you're particularly adept at developing, say, dashboard widgets.
Okay.
Okay, you could go ahead and create a dashboard widget that would allow you to search the AADL catalog, retrieve results from that search, all within the widget, and then go ahead and place a request on any number of those results.
Mm-hmm.
They never have to actually open a browser, browse to our website, and browse to our catalog, put in their search term there. It's all done within this small little application that they've developed for themselves.
Right.
And then what they can do then is package that little app up and distribute it to anyone else, and then anyone else can do the same thing with very little overhead, with very little effort. They could just go ahead and install that widget, and they're off and running themselves.
Exactly. Now, has this in fact happened in this case?
I don't think anybody's written a dashboard app yet. I did actually write a couple Google gadgets, which are widgets that appear on the Google homepage,
right. And
I could easily modify that to place requests on holds, but basically the ones that I've created now display top items, new items, checked out items, and requests.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Is there an API now for putting a book on hold?
Yes, I believe there is. I think if it's not in the specification, it's because I haven't updated the specification, but it's in there.
Okay, we'll write it up so I can try it out.
Okay.
So this is a pretty good description of how it is that a piece of functionality can be packaged up in a way that is accessible to not what we would ordinarily call a user, but to someone who's a fairly casual kind of developer, right? Mm-hmm. The kind of a person who could look at an example of what drives a gadget on the Macintosh desktop or maybe on the Windows Vista desktop or on Google, could look at that pattern, could kind of match up how your URL fits into that pattern, and as you say, then produce something which is not only for personal use but is shareable. And you know, that's kind of the key. There's this incredible sort of multiplier effect that comes from that.
And I think another point, John, is that the development environments are getting so powerful these days that if you're using tools and standards that have fairly simple interfaces, you can get a lot of the graphical power that you need and a lot of the interactive power that you need with user interfaces that can be written in, what, 25 lines of code?
Oh, easily.
Literally stuff. I'll apologize to anyone for this, but you know, I don't write code that doesn't fit on one page on my screen.
Right.
I just lose track of it.
Right. A next step here, following along with this Eric von Hippel notion of lead users and user innovation toolkits, is that from your perspective, John, I guess maybe not much of this has yet happened outside of Ed being the leading example here, but in principle, the kinds of things that you see people doing are expressions of their intent, right, of what they want to be able to do.
Right.
As you see the folks who you've enabled in these ways begin to work with the tools that you've given them or the toolkits that you've given them, you see the expression of their intent to do potentially other stuff, different stuff than you imagined they would want to do, and that presumably informs the next round of design of the toolkits that you provide.
And a lot of it is sort of speculation as to what I think users might want to do in the future. So I try to, when I approach the specification, I try to envision what could anybody possibly want to do. You know, would they ever possibly want to be able to tag bibliographical items from within a cell phone app? You know, I mean, who knows? I mean, that's just an example.
Mm-hmm. Right. The question would be, though, to what extent is your observation of how a lead user, in this case Ed, is doing, affect your choices?
I guess I'm not clear of what you're asking. I mean, are you asking to what extent do I think users will actually use this, and how does that affect?
There's this notion out there. The primary guy who's been articulating this is Eric Von Hippel. He's at MIT, and he's got this book called Democratizing Innovation. And in this book, he looks at a lot of different cases where there are what he calls lead users in different industries. And so he looks at the world of software, where it's not surprising to find that people who are Apache administrators are also the ones who are developing some really innovative plugins to handle sort of corner case scenarios around authentication and whatnot. You know, so I mean, we kind of take that for granted. But he also looks in other areas, and so for example, he looks at sporting equipment, and in particular snowboards. And he says, what you actually see is that the lead users, the most radical snowboarders, are the ones who are doing these modifications to their boards, which then work their way into sort of the next generation of extreme snowboards. And the point being that it wasn't that the engineers at the factory sat around and figured out the ideal configuration for a radical next generation snowboard. It's that the people who are out there using the boards were, in the course of using them, making modifications to them. And by observing those modifications, you can see what it is that they're going for, right?
Right.
And
okay.
and that then you can factor that into your design process. And the follow on to that is really the most interesting thing to me, which is that if you take that to be the case, then what you provide to these folks is something ideally that does two things, right? First of all, it meets their immediate need as best as possible. But also, it's been designed in such a way as to enable them more easily to express their intent to modify. In other words, you've given them something which is sufficiently malleable that they can both use it and in their own way improve it. And in the improving that they do, you find out more about what the next iteration of what you provide to them needs to be.
It's an idea based on common sense. I mean, if you're going to provide something like this to your users, you've really got to keep an eye on how it's being used.
Right.
And I think we do that. Obviously, you know, Ed is our biggest consumer.
Right. I'll argue that you've done the right thing instinctively here, and that the right thing was to provide this toolkit, which was expressed in terms of very simple elements. You know, a small set of URL patterns that could be reconfigured very straightforwardly in the context of, like you said, you know, a Macintosh gadget or a Windows gadget or a Google gadget or something like that. It's probably one of the best illustrations of that idea that I can point to at the moment. And I think so. I think you just sort of naturally did that and did the right thing.
I'll give you a perspective on this from my experience doing just general protocol design on the Internet. I've been involved in the protocol-level development of a bunch of things either in common use today or that briefly had their heyday and then went away.
So name a few of those. Just
well, so I was involved in the early development of Gopher.
Mm-hmm.
Was part of the feedback loop for that team as they were expanding out their services and building servers and describing how it could be interfaced with the web and other sorts of things.
Yeah.
I helped Nathaniel Bornstein with putting together the MIME specification for multimedia internet email.
Really? I didn't even know you had a hand in that.
Yes, he wrote an RFC or a draft or something along those lines. And I wanted to prove to myself that I could compose a message that adhered to the standards just by reading the standards. So I typed one out in plain text and sent it to him, and sure enough, it worked. So back in the 92-93 era, I was involved in the development of HTTP and HTML, and actually wrote some of the very early web pages. There's a directory at the University of Toronto that still has some really badly coded HTML pages that I wrote, I think, in the December of 1991.
So it's like an online museum of early web pages.
Yeah, it's kind of like an online museum of early web pages, but from someone who didn't quite understand. So yeah. I didn't understand that it had to have a .html at the end, and
yeah.
I didn't understand boldface and paragraphs and a bunch of other stuff. But
right.
Sort of what kind of feedback can you provide without tools? I just say, okay, I think I understand you. Here's what I think it looks like. How does that work?
Right.
And that sort of iterative development with feedback going on all the time is really a powerful, if you have the right kind of design in the first place, the sort of design that says we're building a modular system, you should be able to do anything with it, it should be easy to guess new features just by changing parameters in a way that's obvious.
That's a key one, easy to guess new features or easy to guess functionality that may not be documented.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's the internet tradition of standards development through rough consensus and running code.
Mm-hmm.
Small amounts of innovation done continuously and periodic review by groups of people who look at the specs for things and determine if the specs accurately reflect the reality of today.
Yeah. So from that perspective, and given that there is rough consensus and running code relative to pat rest,
mm-hmm.
What are the prospects for getting that thing rolled out more widely across, first of all, to other innovative systems, that is, libraries that use the same catalog software that the Ann Arbor library does, but then, as well, as we know, there are dozens of different of these OPAC systems, and potentially many or all of them could sport the same interface. If it actually could become a de facto standard, and then it would be the case that someone who made one of these desktop gadgets that we were talking about for the Ann Arbor Library's innovative system could share it with someone who was using the Voyager system at Antioch here in Keene.
That is my blue sky dream right there. and I'd love to see that happen. There are a lot of technical hurdles to overcome before that happens, though. Given the disparate nature of all the different ILSs out there and the fact that there is no real standard API to build this thing upon currently, I mean, there are some standards, Ed mentioned Z39.50, Dublin Core, MarkXML, but each system supports those types of protocols to varying degrees. And so to find the core component that would allow you to make this a universal protocol, given the state of current systems, is going to be the real challenge. Having said that, so the way that I'm starting to think about approaching this is to create a library that would sort of allow people at other systems to write sort of a tiered library underneath the middleware that kind of creates the presents the distribution layer so that other libraries would be able to create and code in sort of the functions needed to make it operate.
Right.
I think that in terms of getting a widespread distribution of this protocol, I think it's possible. I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done on it. But there has been quite a bit of interest. I have received a lot of emails from a number of different libraries. Usually they're system administrators that are interested in pursuing this.
Right.
And a couple of vendors, too, have expressed interest in learning more about it and just, starting the initial discussions as to, how it might be useful to them,
mm-hmm.
how they might implement it. So there's interest. I wouldn't say there's a lot of interest.
It's a somewhat esoteric thing, and I think it's true that for most of these vendors, it's still early days in terms of even providing something like an RSS feed. This is a couple of steps beyond that, but I hope that they'll start to figure out that this is very much in their interest.
Yeah, we're somewhere on the outer reaches of a spiraling critical mass, you know, eventually libraries will have to look at their systems this way to do business.
Yeah.
We are purveyors of information, after all. So I think that there is a critical mass somewhere off in the distance, somewhere on the horizon. How far we are from that, I don't know, but when we reach that point, I think these types of things are going to become a lot more important in our discussions, and we'll get a lot more attention.
It is a bit of a chicken and egg kind of thing, and so right now there are relatively few people who have the expectation that things should work this way, and so it's hard to jumpstart that, because the only way people can have the expectation that things should work this way if they've had the experience of things working this way.
Right.
So it's a real bootstrap problem,
right.
But you're really well positioned, I think, to be there if and when this kind of catches on, and you're also doing more than anyone to make it possible for people to have the experience, which gives them the aha moment, which then causes them to start making the kinds of demands of their libraries and then the libraries of the vendors.
If anything, I think it's a shift between the power coming from the vendors who mostly sell systems to library directors who are mostly concerned to make sure their circulation works.
Right.
To the power shifting to the library patrons, especially the online patrons who say, hey, you know, I can look this thing up in Amazon 10 times faster than I can look it up in your library or Netflix or whatever.
Exactly. Okay. Well, thanks very much, guys.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks, John. Thanks, Ed.
Bye-bye.